Hi, good morning.
Good morning, is that the rabbi?
Yep.
Oh, great. Good morning, Rabbi Shavuot.
Thank you.
Hope you're well.
Yes,
Jim is online with me.
What was that?
Jim is online also.
Oh, hey there, Jim. Hey there, Rivka.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Dad. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Hope you had a good week.
Hey, good morning, Josh.
Hey, John.
Hey, John.
Hi.
Hey, how are you? You're good. Is it below 100 there? It's supposed to be there this week sometime, I think. It's been like record highs here.
Here in Washington?
No, it's Phoenix.
In Phoenix, 100, oh wow. A little more than I can handle.
How high did it get, Josh? You mean like in the summer? No, I mean you said you're having a record high. So how high? I'm not exactly sure. I mean, this past week I know it got up to at least like 108, somewhere in there.
Wow. Oh my gosh.
It's pretty hot for this time of year, I guess. Yeah.
Wow.
It's the hottest Dakota I've ever experienced. yeah, that would be a different Dakota challenge than others face. Right.
I have someone out in California who said it was 108 this week.
Yeah.
That's a little bit awful.
Good morning,
Francesca. Hi, good morning.
Okay, so we're ready to start?
Absolutely.
Okay, so we're in the chapter 7, verse 23, we're up to now.
So, Deb, I have one question before you begin. I always look to Koholis and Mishle to answer the life's big questions. And you're hard to cope. And I would feel like the answers are in there. How to cope the overwhelming problems and getting through life. And when we look at other people and it seems like people have it easier and we have it so much harder. How do we look at it in a sensible way that has the wisdom of Torah in it that we should hold on to and not let all the facts and trials and tribulations pull us down? What is the answer? Is it one answer? Is it several answers? Is there a way of looking at things like that?
Well, there's a lot of study that has to be done. It's not, again, it's not something that can be answered quickly, and it also requires each individual studies those topics. Just to have the question without knowledge, some basic knowledge. So the person may not be satisfied.
Not so much as an answer, but an attitude to have.
No. Let me finish.
Yeah, okay.
That the a person that doesn't have the right background, even if they get an answer, they may not accept it because they're looking for something else. They don't have knowledge in the area. Like if a person tells you, a person's looking to study how do you make a building. But if they don't have, and if they're told, well, it's a process of first forming the bricks and then precision alignment and using a level and understanding the stability of certain materials that are in the lower part of the building that are not required in the higher part because of weight, and then there's weight distribution and all the materials that are weather, that can take on the weather. So a person who doesn't have any knowledge of what a building really requires may get frustrated with all the required background that's needed. They just want to know, just put up the walls and that's it, because they're looking at it from an emotional and ignorant, perspective. So even if you tell them how to do it, it may not be received well. If the person, however, first studies and sees what's involved and how soil, there could be a defective soil if you dig in one area, so the soil that's adjoining that part now becomes weaker because it doesn't have any stability from the amount of soil that was on its left side, so now it weakens that whole soil there that has a change, and there's so many different factors. So then if a person studies that, then you explain to them all the principles, then it'll make complete sense, and it'll really jive with their mind, and they'll appreciate the wisdom that of the answer. But until the person understands all these different factors, so they're not really in a situation to receive the answer. That's a very important aspect of the question you're asking, that there's a certain amount of a certain number of prerequisites that are required. And also a person's looking for happiness too. Well, how do you define happiness? The terms have to be defined first. You tell a person how to get happiness and it doesn't include money, they may walk away from you very frustrated because in their mind that's what happiness meant. So they didn't study what happiness means first. So to answer a question, how do you have a good life when there's trials? Well, do you know what the word good means? Do you know what that is, number one? Number two, who says that what's considered a tribulation is really a negative? That the Talmud talks about that certain oppressive situations that people went through were really welcomed by them. And the attitude, there's a lot to study. So even our concept of what an oppressive or a difficulty in life is, that's something which has to be questioned. Is that really a difficulty? Maybe you're looking at it from a perspective which is not founded in reason. So all these different things have to be isolated and examined on their own, and then a person may find that what they looked at was a problem. Maybe it's even something which is they were causing themselves. That's what Maimonides says. The majority of problems a person causes to themselves. But also, what is a problem and what's not a problem? So that's why this book is not a short book. We've been doing this book for years now, and we're still just about halfway through. So there's a lot to be examined.
Yes. I hear that. I'm just talking about this person who I was speaking to that is just totally overwhelmed because life is just, there's one problem after the other, and there isn't enough energy and time to do everything that has to be done in order to try to even make a living and survive.
Well, again, that has to be addressed on an individual basis. In terms of specific specific cases, are we talking about the rule or are we talking about specific cases? But the important thing is that a person first has the rules in place. And, in terms of ambition, and sometimes people try to strive for too much and they can't just live each day individually. There's just too many specifics when you talk about an individual case that has to be addressed in a one by one scenario, but in general, a general rule I would say is that if a person can appreciate his role in life and that it's temporary and that the real enjoyment he can get is from learning, so that if a person does that on a regular basis, most of their problems, I think, will fall by the wayside, because people tend to hone in on specifics and get caught up with every single specific. And if they were involved, not looking at themselves and their life and looking to make sure every single thing is lined up perfectly. A lot of people have a very anal approach to life with everything they want to be on top of, or everything has to be specifically good. And it's not, it's to have things in a general sense of order, where you have your food, you have your bills paid, and you're not trying to have a perfection in every area. Like, I guess the most specific case I can think of is people who do plastic surgery. And the truth is, most people that have it, they don't have it one time, they have it 10 times, because it's that personality type that wants everything to be perfect. They're too absorbed in the body. And it all comes from the fact that they're looking at the self and they're not pursuing something external to the self. Because really, happiness comes when a person has his attention placed on something which the mind gets absorbed in, and that the greatest thing for the mind to be absorbed in is wisdom. Everything else is it comes to a brick wall, because anything which is man-made, any activity or pursuit or fantasy, that is, there's an end to it. So if a man wrote a book, there's only a certain amount of knowledge an individual has, but if he's studying God and his works, then it's like an endless sea, and you have to open one door, there's another door, and then you find another treasure behind that one, and it's an endless pursuit. The self is completely out of the picture, and that's really enjoyment when the person is pursuing something which satisfies the mind, not the self. Once a person is going through the world of the emotions and the self, then they're going to be hit with frustration, and they're going to realize that all the fantasies are not going to be met because God didn't design life that you should be satisfied physically. That should be the ends. It's a means. So perspective, you know, again, it depends on the person, but the perspective that a person has to have, really wants to be happy, is to understand the general rules, that happiness comes from pursuing knowledge and from the mind's involvement in something which is endless. That does not allow any frustration. That's I think, the most general rule in terms of where a person is going to pursue and find, you know, satisfaction, something fulfilling. There also has to be the person has to work on their own self, because everybody's got their own set of emotions, and they may have been living a certain way. So they also have to break down the false value system that they have. But that's also going to come from studying and seeing, well, if that's false, what's the reality? So that, again, the only way out of it is study, is examination. And that's what actually our verses deal with today. King Solomon says that, he says in verse 23, it's a new verse, so this is a new ground for us. And okay. He says, all this I have tested, I have tried with wisdom. I said to myself, I'll become wise, but it was distant from me.
Uh-huh.
And then he says further, he says in 24, very far, very distant is that which was. And deep, deep, he repeats the word deep. Who's going to find it out? Who can uncover this? And then finally he says in this series of verses, I've returned my heart. I returned myself, and I've looked at my heart to know and to explore and to seek out wisdom and calculation and to understand the wickedness of the fool and the madness of folly. Okay. So you said the mouthful here. There's a lot here.
Yes, I hear.
Okay.
Yes, thank you.
So
thank you. It means that we have to have the strength and the patience to explore, to study, and through that we will have answers. Things will seem clearer.
Of course.
Yeah. Thanks so much, Rabbi. Thank you.
Okay.
Rabbi?
Yes, Doug.
Can I just check the facts on my translation versus where we're going? On verse 24, mine says, what was is far off, and it is very deep. Who can find it?
Good.
I just want to make sure that's similar enough to yours that I can kind of focus on those words and not...
it's distant. What was, meaning the past, is very distant. It's far off.
So can we ask questions?
Please. No, I'm sorry, you can't. No questions today.
Yeah, no questions. So I'm looking at 23, and he says, all this I tested with wisdom, and I said, I'll become wise, but it was far from me. Okay? So he's saying, I'm going to test this stuff with wisdom. Then he goes in and says something here in the middle, not quite sure what. And then we get over to 25, and he says, I turned about with my heart to know and to search out and to seek wisdom. Like, well, wait a minute. Isn't that what you just were trying to do in 23? And now you're coming back in 25 and said, well, now I'm seeking wisdom. So, like, what happened? Did you take a detour? Or it seems like that's a strange juxtaposition.
Okay, well, there's a difference here.
Okay.
In 23, if you notice, he says, all this I tried with wisdom. Then in 25, he says that I returned myself on my, and in my heart Sabosi Ani Valivi, myself and my heart. Where the Oculus has it, I mean the translation has it as a, I returned to ponder my heart. So there, and what does it say? It says to know and to search out, and to ubakesh, and I sought out wisdom. Here it's not saying that wisdom was the tool. Here it says he sought out wisdom as the subject. So first he's saying that he used wisdom in his application for his search. So it's different. It's not that he did the same thing twice. It seems to me you were asking, it seemed like he did the same thing twice, right?
Right.
But no, he's not saying. In verse 23, he says all this, referring now to his search for good. What is the good for man? Everything he's looking for, the right value is too much wisdom or too much folly or and different, you see he has explored so much and then he stops here all of a sudden, which of course we have to understand. If you don't mind, Doug, I don't know if you're taking notes, but if you want to just write down the questions because we're not going to answer everything today. There's just so much in these verses, but I would like to have just a list of questions. We may stay on this for, you know 2 weeks or so. But
okay.
One question off the bat is, what is this doing right here? Why does he insert this comment here at this point in his book? This is number one. But let's just make sure that you understand the answer to your question. In verse 23, he's saying now, for whatever reason he stopped here and now made the statement, he says, what did I do? What are the facts? All this search for the good, for the best life for man that I've been looking for, King Solomon says, I have tried with wisdom. And I said, I'll become wise, meaning I had the conviction that I'll arrive at the answers. But it was far from me. And then he says, very far off is that which happened in the past. And very deep. And he says the word twice. Why does he say it twice is another question. And then he says, who will find it out? Interesting, though, at the end of 23, he says, it is far from me. And in the end of 24, he says, who will find it out? It seems to be juxtaposing man and the subject of the search. And in both cases, it sounds like he's saying, man's not going to find it. So that's another question. So what comes out of that is that, so if you're not going to find it, what type of existence is this? That's another big question. Then your question comes up in 25 where he says that I return now in my heart to know and to search out and seek wisdom. Meaning there now, he's not saying that he used wisdom in terms of what we said in 23, but now he just says, now I returned upon my heart. Or maybe he's looking into himself now to seek out the wisdom. So that's a different thing. To say that I'm looking for wisdom is different than to say that I applied wisdom in my search. So at least we have a distinction. It's not repetitive. Let me just see if you have any other questions.
Rabbi?
Yes.
So the first verse 23, saying that he used wisdom as he applied it in his search and the answers that he found, he couldn't understand.
He said it was distant from me. Ibn Ezra says on this, I'll read you the commentaries. Okay, so Ibn Ezra says, all this which I said, all this I've searched out, I've tried it, I've tested it, all these different opinions, all these different thoughts, you know, throughout the book so far. So I tried it with wisdom, and I desired that I should become wise, even more. And I found out, I discovered, that it is a very, very distant matter, a far-off matter. And this is also reiterated by what King Solomon said when he said, do not become too wise. Meaning when he said, don't just be involved in wisdom your entire life and then you forget taking care of your bodily needs and your physical, you know, needs for sustenance. And Ibn Ezra goes on and he says, for the essence is very deep, that man should find it. It's very, very, the depths of the wisdom is very deep. Another explanation Ibn Ezra quotes, he says that I sought out to become wise, and I found it very distant from me. But even so, I did reach it, and I became wise. So another opinion is that he did find it. That's just two opposing opinions. So we'd have to understand those two. Let's see, Sforno. So Sforno says, all this that I searched out with wisdom to ponder and to form certain ideas about the matter. I said that I'd become wise when I used my powers of my intelligence. But it was very distant from me. And he says, what does that mean? Inasmuch as the level of wisdom of man, that's my only power, that is very distant from the level of the true matter, the true wisdom, which is really God's knowledge. Meaning the truth of something is formed by God. And that's very distant from man's abilities to really have the same knowledge. It's impossible for man to have the same knowledge as God. So he's making the commentary here that to get the complete knowledge of something is impossible. Doesn't mean that he can't get something. Right? And maybe that's what the dispute in Ibn Ezra is. One view is saying that, no, there is knowledge you can get. Does that mean you're getting knowledge of God? No. So both opinions in Ibn Ezra can be correct. When Ibn Ezra says that I sought out something and it was far from me, that means that on the one hand, you'll never get to the level of God's knowledge. That would mean you're God. It's impossible. Man can't have the same knowledge as God. Man just doesn't have that ability. Nonetheless, there is knowledge you can reach. Okay. Again, why is he telling us this? That's the main question. Go on. Let me just see if I answer what you asked so far. Did I answer your question, Francesco?
I think so. Yeah.
All right. So he says, all this I've tried with wisdom. But you see, he says that's the only thing he used. What was the only tool he used? Wisdom.
His mind.
That's right. That's the only thing which can uncover the explanations. Inasmuch as he, in his book, is searching out for truth, and what's the best thing for man in his existence? You know, the big question that we all have. But there was no question that he had about how to go about it. You see no questions over here. There may be questions about the righteous, the suffering, and the wicked, or being successful, and so on and so forth, and all these different questions. And who knows, and again, remember, we said that whenever he says things like, who knows if the end is any different? The man and the animal, they die the same. So that's King Solomon verbalizing the opinions of foolish people. But he says that in order to bring those questions to the foreground. And then he can answer them. Of course, he didn't have these opinions. He knew the Torah. But he brings them out as a manner, and a method by which he can awaken people to say, yeah, that's right, I have that question. But all those different statements that he has, that even in question form, that is not, he never says, who knows whether wisdom is better than that. There he says openly, he says, wisdom is like light. And then ignorance is like darkness. And he says it open. That's not put in a question form. So here also you see that the only thing he used in order to approach the answer was wisdom. He says it clearly here. Okay. Now, let's take up another interesting point over here. He says in 24, very distant is what happened in the past. Deep, very deep. Who's going to find it out? Okay, you think about that verse and tell me what the question is. I'm sure there's more than one. Just based on the facts alone, what seems to be a new point over here, right? And what might be the question? I also just want to add to it that when he's talking about very far off is that which happened in the past, Rashi says, the matters that are very far off that were in the formation of the world, in Genesis. He also quotes, there's a Mishnah in Chagiga, Talmud Chagiga, that says that there are four things that if a person ponders them, better off that he was never created. And that is what came before the earth and what's going to come after the earth. What's above the earth and what's below the earth. Meaning, before the earth and after the earth means in terms of time, the areas of time that are not subject to investigation. We don't know how to refer to anything prior to natural law. So before there was an earth, a universe, is useless to ponder. And the same thing afterwards. That's in terms of the spectrum of time. But there's also a spectrum of space. So in space, where are the areas that are going to be off limits to us? What is beyond exploration? Something which is too far away, that's called above the earth. And something which is too hidden, too buried, that's below the earth. So he's making a comment that in this area, it's very difficult. Once he starts opening up this can of worms of what, I want to know what happened in Bereshis, in Genesis, so now that's going to be severely limited too. I believe Sforno also says the same thing. He says, very far off. So, very far off from my approach is what happened in the formation. In order to form any idea, what happened in Genesis. And he goes on and he says, very deep is it? The matter of creation. That it was the work of the poel. It's the work of the worker, meaning God, without man. Meaning that this is something which, what do you mean without man? Of course it was without man. What is Ibn Ezra telling you? I mean, Sforno telling you that the reason why it's so deep is because creation was the work of God without man. What does he mean?
Well, if it was the work of God without man, then it would seem like that it would not have been done in a way that man can understand because man's limited to the physical dimension and God would work outside of that.
Excellent. Excellent. You say it again.
So, if it's without man, and man is limited to the physical dimension, then God would generally not, I'm not sure I have a proof for this small point of it, but God would not work solely in the physical dimension. God would work within the realm of God, and we would be unable to comprehend that because man is limited to the physical.
Right, but just to embellish your point is that whatever God did and whatever was the wisdom in the creation of the world, so that's not part of the world. Meaning you could see it once it's there, but in its formation, so that was, like you're saying, that was something which was out without all of the physical laws at that point. It wasn't until God created the world that all the physical laws were there. Then man could penetrate to some point. Right. So that's what King Solomon is saying when he says it's very far off, is it? Because it's outside of the actual workings of the human mind. That's why scientists say the same thing correctly, that they can only try to analyze up to the point of creation, but not a moment before. Because the moment before creation, there was nothing natural, and human mind works by the cause and effect. It works in a natural form, in a natural process. Okay. It's like trying to guess what's in a black box. There's no way to penetrate because it's completely opaque. So it's outside of the realm of human reason to try to. There's no tools by which you can do that.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
So two questions on the source that you cited. I think you said Rabbi Hagiga?
Talmud. Talmud Hagiga.
Sorry. It said it's better that a person not even be born than to think about those things. That seems like a pretty extreme statement, given man's natural curiosity. I mean, I think people would sort of naturally wonder, well, what was there before the universe?
Let me get the actual quote. Hold on. Yeah, what was the second question you had?
The second question, when you talked about, there were four things, and one of them was what's above the earth, but then what was beneath the earth. Is he talking there literally about the core of the planet? Because I don't know how you'd go, I don't understand what beneath the earth would mean.
Meaning a place which is unpenetrable, impenetrable. That's what it means to say. It's 11b in Talmud Hagiga. It says, one who ponders on four matters, better off that he was not created, that he did not come to the world. What is above, what is below, what is before the earth, and what comes afterwards. All right, that's a Mishnah, right in the beginning of the second chapter of Talmud Hagiga. So what it means that it's very extreme is because the person is trying to discover things that are impossible. So if he pursues this, and that, this is his whole life, so that's it. He's not going to get the answers, and he's not using his existence to gain anything which is really fathomable for man. It's saying the same thing. A person tries to flap his wings hard enough to fly. That's all he does in his life. His life is useless.
I'm
trying to do something which is
useless. I got you.
Yeah. Look at the first question before. Also a very good question, in 24. What is this over here that he's looking to discover Genesis? What is this doing over here? Right, he says, very far off is that which happened already, meaning Genesis, creation. Right, Rashi says that's what he's referring to, and so does the Sforno. Right, Ibn Ezra just talks about anything in general in the past. It's very far off, and it's hard for man to really discover it. All right, then, of course, what is Ibn Ezra getting at? Well, let's take Rashi and Sforno that explain King Solomon's words to refer to his exploration of Genesis. What is that doing over here? I understand the last part of the verse. It's very deep because, like you said, Doug, very well, really excellent, that it's something which is God without man. Meaning, this was prior to the natural laws, and therefore it's something which a person can't know. That's what Elihu, when he was rebuking Job had all these questions on God's justice. So his rebuke was that you don't understand how the ostrich lays its eggs, or how the certain laws of nature and lightning and snow and all these different natural things. So if that, and he put that in the question form to Job, and he says, do you know all these things? Were you there with God when he did this? Meaning you don't have all this knowledge. How could you have knowledge about something which is even more abstract, which is justice? Justice is not a physical law that you can view in nature and at least extrapolate some truths. So if you don't even know the natural laws of snow and animals and weather and lightning, and so certainly, and those are tangible, so certainly, Job, how could you have questions on justice? So that's something which is far off.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
So, is it possible that up until this point, King Solomon's been laying out a whole bunch of issues, and then in 23, he says, all this I tested with wisdom, and I said, I will become wise. So let me pause there. So he says, okay, I got all these problems and these questions in life, and so what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to test everything with wisdom. And in that process, he says, okay, so I'll go back to the very beginning, and I'll start with the creation of the world and try to understand that and then move forward to man. And but then he goes back and he realizes creation is very far off and it's very deep and it's impossible to find. So he's, and this is an answer to the question, what's this doing here? It almost seems like he's pausing and saying, okay, I'm going to try to get wise here. And in order to do that, I got to look at the whole picture, so I'll start at the beginning. But now that I look at the beginning, it's way too complicated.
Why look at the beginning?
Only because if you're going to try to understand the totality of something, you'd probably start at the beginning of it rather than in the middle.
Okay, why? What is significantly different at the beginning than the middle?
Because the beginning lays the foundation for what is now. So, for example, if I wanted to understand a building, I would, in its totality, I would probably start at the basement rather than the 10th floor, because that's where the foundation is built up from, and then I could see why the architect developed the girders and the rivets and all the stuff the way he did, because of the way he set the foundation.
Would you apply the same thing to the human body?
How'd we get the human body here?
Well, if you're looking for knowledge in general, it's not just limited to architecture. It's all areas. So your rule has to apply to all areas. So I'm testing your rule.
It does help with the human body. I was reading a treatise on the heart for school a while back, and circulation wasn't understood very well. But some of the things that we did learn about circulation came because we realized which parts of the heart had developed before other parts of the body.
Okay. So what rule can we extrapolate over here in terms of why King Solomon at this point now says, I'm going to go look at creation? She's saying that creation is going to be something different that can be discovered, which cannot be discovered later on, after the formation. Is that what we're saying as a step?
Yeah, so, okay, if I wanted to understand cement, if I look at my patio, it will be different than if I go back and look at how cement is made from its original ingredients and how it comes together and what causes it to form a hard substance. So I have to go back to the foundation, and it will, you know, it will physically have changed from what it was at the source to what it is now in its end product. So maybe he's saying he wanted to go back to the source to try to understand the nature of the thing.
Very good. That's what I was saying.
That's excellent.
Yeah, let's take another example. Let's take a chair. The person looks at a chair. He wants to understand it by looking at it in its finished state. And, just put on your mute, a lot of feedback, so we can put on the mute buttons, please. So, if you look at the chair in the finished state, so when I see the metal and all the different formation, was the metal carved out a larger brick of metal that way, or was the metal made flat and then bent? I mean, how is there a curve in this part of the metal? When I look at the seat cushions and I see fabric, but then I sit on it and it's soft, so that's, I have one, I could form one idea about it. But unless I take it apart or there when they're actually weaving the fabric, I may have a wrong idea about the fabric. Maybe this fabric grew this way. No, if I look at the beginning, I see that the whole process of weaving that created the fabric. And then I see that there are two pieces that were sewn together, but the stitches on their inside, and I can't see that. And by seeing the stitches on the inside, I can now understand that they were purposefully hidden for an aesthetic quality. All right, and then when I think about why certain parts are rigid and hard and certain parts have the cushion on the inside, I can appreciate further in terms of how it applies, how it fits to the human body, and how certain parts are there for stability and certain parts are there for comfort. So I think, like you said, Doug, yes, that's what I think King Solomon is doing. When you go back to the beginning, you can isolate the specific elements, and you could understand more about the object, because looking at a finished chair, you don't see the process, the procedure of the sewing. You don't see the procedure of the weaving. But if you go back to the beginning at its formation, so King Solomon's rule is, there I will see more knowledge. I'll see much more knowledge if I go back to the beginning. I'm getting feedback again, so if you could shut off, put on the mute button, please. All right. Let's see here. Yeah, so the formative process of something is going to afford greater knowledge in terms of the elements. Like you said, Doug, looking at cement, you can't tell what the elements are. Well, maybe you could break them down, and today you have procedures where you can isolate. All right, that's something. But definitely you'll see more of an accurate view when you go back to the procedure of the mixing, and what were the quantities and what else was added to this mixture. Looking at cement, you don't know that there's water inside. Another thing you don't see is that there may have been certain specific considerations made. So if I look at a chair, so I'm looking at a complete unit, and but if I see it at the beginning, I may see the legs as a separate component. I may see the arm rests as another component before they're assembled. And I see the back, and I see the seat, and I see the actual metal screws and bolts that are used to put it together. And then when I see how it's built, maybe that also tells me more. So the formative process not only gives you information about greater number of components that are there that you can't see, but also the material substances is one thing, but what about the parts? The parts of the chair, the armrest, the legs, and so on. Now you can appreciate different parts, because a person may be looking at a chair, oh, it's a place to sit. He doesn't think about the armrest or the backrest and so on. If he makes a chair and he leaves out the backrest, then he'll appreciate the support that really and the comfort it gives him. So again, I think it's clear that what he was doing here, that's where he goes back to creation. He goes back to find out greater knowledge. I think it's a very, to me, it sounds like it's a very profound idea, too. The fact that he had this ability to make that discovery, that he could look at something now, and That's one type of knowledge you can get from it. But if it goes back to the beginning, the formation, then I'll see much more insight. What was the intent for all the parts? What's the intent for all the substances? The procedure of assembly and so on. All right, everybody see that?
Yes.
Okay.
Great example. There's no way of seeing it completely. It's, as Doug said before about the cement, that was a beautiful example. There's no way you're seeing the, what you call the sand and the water, and afterwards seeing the pavement dried and people were stomping on it, cars going over it. You would never know from the beginning how the end would be.
Right.
And this is how the example is so perfect.
Right. And I think also that when it says that I wanted to become wise, but it was far from me at the end of 23, and the end of 24, he says about this process of going back to creation, he says it's very deep. I mean, it's far away, it's far from man. And it is also something which is not even within the realm of man, because me, Yim said, who's going to find it out? What does he mean to say, who's going to find this out? It was like the point we said before. Let me see if it was on this very point, actually. Yes, on this very point, Sforno says that it's the work of the Creator without man. That's why King Solomon says very subtly, who's going to find this out? Since it's something which is not human, it was which God did. So that's why he says, who could find it out? Man can't find it out. It's something which you really just can't fathom, because this is something which is doesn't happen. God's creation was not something within the realm of the natural. That was the actual creation of what natural is. So he wasn't using nature to create nature. He was using God's wisdom. And since it's God's wisdom, that's something which you can say very accurately, who can find out God's wisdom? Man can't find it out, because man only works with natural principles of the mind, cause and effect. We can't think outside of the realm of cause and effect. Now, cause and effect, that's something which is natural. So before those laws were created, then that's it. We can't penetrate further. That's why he says, who can find it out? He's trying to show you it's not a human thing. All right, I just want to make that clear. And he repeats it.
Right. Yeah, this is exactly what I started with the conversation with earlier this morning when I asked the question, when I was speaking to somebody about the problems and the trials and tribulations that the person was going through. I said, there's no way that you could possibly understand it. It's just too profound. And she was saying she just couldn't understand why the world is the way it is. It makes no sense. I said, it can't make sense. We don't have the ability to understand what the word sense means in the capacity that it really is. And it's just, the whole thing is so complicated and so profound that it's very hard, but you're explaining it. It's very good. Thank you, Rabbi. It's very good that you're bringing all this out. It's beyond us. It's beyond us because we don't have the ability.
That's not actually completely, that's not completely accurate. We're not saying that everything is beyond us. That's not what we're saying. Again, we didn't finish it off yet. Right now, we're saying that to look at the beginning is impossible. But that does not mean that it's beyond. He did a study, and King Solomon made numerous conclusions. So that's not accurate to say that it's too complicated. There are certain aspects, and that's right now we have to be clear. We're talking about creation. Now, King Solomon's attempt was to understand things as best as possible by looking at the formative process. But that is something which he realized he couldn't do. That's something which is outside the realm of how a human being thinks. But look at the next verse. So then what? Did he stop? Did he give up and say it's too complicated and we can't know it? No, he didn't do that. Look at what he does. Look at the next verse. He returns now in his heart and he ponders his heart. He looks inside himself to understand, to explore, and to seek out wisdom and calculations, and to understand the wickedness of foolishness and the damage of Fowler. I think one of the explanations was of power. So what does he do now? He doesn't stop the search. God gave us wisdom for a reason. So that means we have to be able to attain wisdom. Otherwise, that would be a futile thing. God does not do anything futile. So if he gave us wisdom, that means we have the ability. And the Talmud says there's only four things that are beyond our grasp. But other things we are allowed and we must explore. And that's what King Solomon was doing. So when he realizes that in terms of the formation, that's something which he can't do, but that's not all there is to discover. What else can you do to discover truths?
Keep studying.
Study? Well, yeah, what? If it's not the formation of the world and man, so what, if that you can't study, so what is he studying now?
Sounds like he's studying human interaction and behavior and tendencies, the things that attract man.
But what's the category that fits into? If it's not the formation of man, it's the
current state.
The current state, exactly. Meaning the product. So he realized he couldn't understand by looking at the formation. That was outside the realm of how my human mind thinks. But once everything is formed, and now that we're within the confines of nature, what I can do is I can explore and look into my heart and understand, like you were saying, Cal, human nature, meaning what's the current state? What is the product? It's the product I can understand. That I can do. And I can look at the damage and all the effects and calculations. We'll have to go deeper into this verse, but I'm just trying to show the structure of what he's doing here.
How man interacts with that environment,
right, but
that he's been put into.
But he's studying man itself, the product. What he was trying to do in verse 24 is, let's see, can we explore the formation? If we can, of course we'd have greater knowledge. And he's right. His thinking was correct. The only thing is, sometimes you have a good plan, but there's other obstacles. Had those obstacles not been there, you would have been successful. So he realized there's an obstacle over here. The exploration itself can't be done because I'm trying to study that which is outside of my very, how the mind works. I just can't apply it. The mind cannot. I can't think what is inside that black box. It's off limits. There's no sensory I can get from it because it's something which worked prior. It was created in a fashion that was not natural, and my mind only works in a natural fashion. So he says that can't be done. However, I can explore once it is formed, once everything is created. Then I could explore it and look at the actual components of the human and the mind and what is the effects, the results of certain lifestyles. So now this gives us a structure in terms of what his approach was over here. So the questions we still have to answer are, what is this doing over here all of a sudden? Why is he inserting this here? And we have to get to the bottom of 25 also. We just showed what he's doing with verse 25. But now we have to go to specific. What is he lining up? What are the components in this verse in 25? But you see how if you're sensitive to the verses, how he repeats the word from me in 23, the last word, and then at the end of 24 he says it is very deep, far off from me. But again, he's trying to show you that me, meaning man, is something which is too distant from man. Why is it distant from man? Because it was prior to anything natural. The procedure of creation was something didn't take place in a fashion that the human mind can penetrate. Okay. But it doesn't mean that we can't, get a certain amount of knowledge. And that would be the next verse, 20, 25. And we also underlined the point that in 23, he said wisdom was the only tool to use to understand this. And that is never questioned in his book. Because there is a design on how things operate. And he realized that wisdom is the only thing you have in order to penetrate that, to see any rhyme or reason. And then the words deep, deep. Why does he repeat that in 24? When he starts to explore creation? So it's deep in two ways. Maybe perhaps being far off in time, but just the nature itself is far off because it's not something which complies with the thinking of man. There's certain areas that are completely closed off to men. Moses wanted to know God's nature, and God said to him, man cannot know me while you're alive. In your current state, there's a certain area that's impossible. But you could definitely study, and there's a lot you could learn in your life. One second, I just want to see Ibn Ezra over here. Okay, all right, so let me stop here and see if there are any questions or comments.
I think we're good here.
Yeah, Rabbi?
Yes.
The last statement you made, man cannot know me, meaning God, while he is alive. So right. Does that mean that after 120 years or however long a person lives, then he will know God the way we are supposed to know him? We will understand at that point, but we have the ability to understand.
Well, the Maimonides talks about that the wise men, they anticipated the next world, and he said that that's something which they anticipated. He said that what happens there is that there is a benefit of, how he puts it, that they sit with the crowns on their heads, benefiting, enjoying God's presence. So he doesn't say much on that. But clearly all the rabbis explain how that's going to be a greater level of knowledge than we have here. And a greater enjoyment.
Yeah, they make a statement to the effect that after 120 years we'll understand. So you're saying that, in some effect, that really is accurate, that the rabbis, the sages, who were godly, faithful, and had the faith of the prophet in Hashem to the point where they could really, in a sense, wear a crown on their head, will be able to get the answers if they couldn't get the answers of the earth.
I don't know. Again, we don't know what they're going to get, but definitely is going to be an existence where a person is not, his mind is not limited by sensual, sensory perception. There's going to be a great reward that those who enjoy wisdom in this life are going to reap, and that's going to be in the realm of wisdom.
Okay.
What the specifics are, we can't say.
Okay, I see what you're saying. Good. That's something to look forward to. And that's only if the person has lived a true life here.
Yeah, only if a person pursued wisdom. Only if a person pursued truth and trained his mind and spent, the hours. That's really what he looked forward to. That's what he enjoyed in his life. He pursued wisdom because he enjoyed it. If he's pursuing wisdom just to, score points, but he doesn't enjoy the process, so that's not really perfection. There's something to that. You could say maybe the person stays on the path. He'll get to. He definitely will if he stays on the path of study, even though it may be difficult at first. He eventually will start seeing enjoyment from it and greater knowledge, and the process itself will be enjoyable, and the study of the rabbis and the prophets will become more and more enjoyable as he progresses. And then his study will become just for the enjoyment itself, as he's curious, just like a scientist locks himself away for weeks in a laboratory to figure out. He's not doing it for any other motive.
Uh-huh.
He's just curious about understanding something. So that has to be the attitude. That's what we call love of God. Love of God means where a person's attached to ideas. He's attached to wanting to know more about the universe that God created.
And having the faith to know that at some point that the answers will come. In other words, we have enough faith and done enough studying, even something as puzzling to the point of there is no answer in this world. He can have the faith and he can look forward to the future to say, somehow, maybe after 120 years or however long I live, I will know the answer. The answer will be there for me. I know that God is a good God, and somehow the answers will come.
A person doesn't know. I mean, a person doesn't know what answers he's going to get. And if he's curious...
He'll have a clear understanding. He'll have a clear understanding at that point. Things that are impossible to understand now...
No, we don't know. We don't know what we're going to... Again, I said that before. We don't know what we're going to know in the next life. That, again, nobody has been there and come back and told us.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing we could do, again, is we live this life the best possible, and that is where we're pursuing wisdom because we enjoy it, not because of another motive. We pursue wisdom, and if we don't get answers, we don't. Will I get that answer in the future? I don't know. It's not about the answers. It's about the process of the pursuit becomes an enjoyable process. And what we find out in the future, we don't know.
Yeah, I'm still on that first question I had in the beginning of the class where I said that I had no answer to give this woman except to say that maybe at some point after 120 years she'll understand. But at this point, she has to have enough faith to know that God is a good God and that there's reasons now.
Well, that has to be explained to her. Faith is not, again, Judaism is not about faith in the essential areas of Judaism, meaning to say we don't have faith that God exists. We have proof. We don't have faith that this is a good world. We have proof. So she has to first get to the point where she studies intelligently and sees for herself that all the evidence of the Creator being fair and just and wise. And when she has that, then she won't have a question anymore. She'll see that certain areas, maybe she just doesn't know. Person sees how math works, and he's studying it for 10, 20, 30 years, and then he finds a few problems that don't fit. He doesn't trash all of math.
Mm-hmm.
So she has to do the same thing. She has to commence a study based on wisdom to see how God created the world and how it operates, and she has to study the rabbis and the prophets. When she gets to that point after 10, 20 years, she'll be in a position now to, and let her ask the question again. I guarantee you she won't have the question at that point if she studies properly. But like I said at the beginning, the questions that people have, sometimes their questions are wrong, or they're asked improperly, or they're based on false premises. So our job is not to respond and try to give an answer to somebody. Anytime we hear a question, we must answer them. No. Sometimes you have to show them what your question is wrong for X, Y, and Z reason. You can't ask this question.
No, this particular question that she had, I had no answer. I don't know who has an answer. Even great rabbis don't have the answer. In reference to the Holocaust, she said, if God was such a good God, why did he let all this happen? And there is, after 120 years afterwards, we'll have more answers. We don't have it now. We just have to know, and we have to trust that God is a good God, and we see that all these other good things are happening. We have to look at all the good. We don't have to look at the bad. We have to. So she says, no, I can't do that. I can't do that until I have that answer.
Well, again, that person, you don't know what is going on emotionally with a person like that. There may be
I felt at such a loss. That's why I brought it up. And I do not know. I do not know how to answer. I just know that my answer was, I know that there has to be some reason, because I have absolute trust that there was a reason.
Well, I wouldn't...
I don't understand it either, but I know that there was a reason that at some point in time, after 120 years, that we'll find the answers.
First of all, let me just correct you on one thing.
Yes.
Man's life is not 120 years. That's taken from God says in next week's Parsha of Noach that in 120 years he's going to bring the flood. So a man's life is not limited to 120. So let's just get rid of that. That's a false notion.
Okay. Yeah.
I think this is more of a specific case that the person has to be spoken to individually. And that question always comes up. And now's not the time or the place for it. In terms of the person could look in the Torah and see that God does promise tremendous calamities. So again, it seems to me she's ignorant a lot of the Torah, and she doesn't understand why calamities do happen more severely to the Jews than others. But I can tell in general that number one, you got to study the whole world and see how everything is good. God gave a person taste buds, and he made fruits taste great, and all the good. And God gave a person lungs, and he created air. He gave us thirst, and he created water, and he made the climate livable, and in most of the continents. So there has to be an exploration, a study, before you just ask these questions, which are a lot of times motivated by a desire to either reject the Torah or because somebody personal that they knew something happened. But why wasn't the same person complaining when negative things, when tragedies happen to people on the other side of the earth? A lot of times people perk up because it personally involved them, not because of a insistence on learning justice. If a person is interested in justice, they'll have the question no matter who gets hurt, whether it's the Jews or somebody else. But if a person has to study and realize that another point is that when things happen great to the Jew or happen very, very severely bad to the Jew, it's for the example of the rest of the nations. And God says that in the Torah. He says that when the negative things happen to the Jews, the other nations will respond and say it is because they broke off the agreement they have with God to keep the Torah, and that's why they had such devastation. Meaning to say that it's going to be a testament to God's Torah that it's true when the tragedies happen, just like when the good happens. And that's what God even says himself. God says that when I destroy you, not utterly, but when I do bring devastation to you, I will do it, and I'll be as glad to do that as I will to bring good. Now, what does it mean God's going to be as happy to bring the bad as to bring the good? Now, let me see. So I'm trying to remember exactly where. Give me one second. But just in general, just let me find the verse. Hold on.
I apologize,
Dale.
You're taking so much time.
No, one second. Just one second.
Okay.
I just want to find the verse for you. So you I don't know where it is, but I believe it says that God to me is glad to bring the curses as the blessings. But the reason that wasn't glad, it means to say that it's for a good. Just as the blessing is to show how the Torah lifestyle, when lived, gets great rewards here, so also when there's devastation to the Jew, that'll also validate the Torah equally. That's what I mean God is glad on both cases. It doesn't mean that it's preferred. It means that they both serve the same objective. Okay, but again, there's a lot you have to hear a person when they talk and to see where they're coming from. But you do have, God says clearly, the tremendous devastation. Women eating their children. I mean, what could be more gruesome and horrifying than that? But that is exactly what the Torah says. So you have that, and this is, okay?
Yes.
All right.
Thank you.
find it right now. I'll see if I can locate it. Okay, so what we got to do for next week then is now hit verse 25 and really try to see if we can take that apart and understand all the components. But at least we see a structure now in what's when we first looked at these verses. But now, and also we have to answer why he inserted these verses at this juncture in his book. Okay. Any other questions or comments? I know you have the next class coming soon.
No, just thank you so much for your time.
Okay, my pleasure.
Everybody.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, so we'll resume next week, same time, and we'll pick up from 7:25. All right?
Okay.
Okay.
Hey, good. Yeah, the question is, Rabbi Moskowitz's class, is that on?
Not today.
Oh,
no.
Okay.
Are we getting, like, I didn't get any emails about it, or how do you guys know?
No.
Neither did I, no.
I think he said it. Ben Aaron.